Hello and welcome to Open Mind UFO Radio. I am your host, Alejandro Rojas, and I have with me Martin Homeless Willis.
Yeah, I'm sort of homeless. Yeah. We're going to be talking about that.
Yeah, we'll talk about that, about your homelessness. Before that, I want to tell people about my guest. This is really exciting, I think. It's that this guy, you know, we've been talking about it quite a bit. Is putting a CubeSat into space. He's got an Indiegogo campaign. And so his name is Dave Cote. And, of course, there's a group of people putting this together. And so we talked to Dave about that, his project to do this, and, you know, how he got interested in UFOs and how the whole thing's going to work and everything. And so this is exciting.
Yeah. I had his counterpart on my show last week.
You did.
I did, yes. And there was people calling in, and it was interesting.
Yeah, trying to one-up us here.
No, you have the main guy there who can answer all the technical questions that the nice gentleman I had last week, his name was Mark Richfield, and unfortunately he didn't have a lot of the facts in front of him and couldn't answer the questions that he couldn't answer a lot of the questions, I should say.
Actually, Dave mentions that he mentioned your show. He said the show went well, but yeah, he felt bad for his buddy there. But he'll talk about that in the interview. However, I didn't really ask anything too technical. I knew the nature of some of your questions, so I did kind of ask along those lines. But I didn't really press because, we do talk about that. So, yeah, so that's really cool. He spoke positively about your show, though.
That's the first one. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a rare occurrence. And so we ought to get into your news and about how you're homeless.
All right. Well, it's not physically homeless, but my live show is going to be homeless because if the listener hasn't heard out there, Art Bell hung up his microphone and his own words for good last Friday. So Thursday, I believe it was his last show. And the network I'm on, Dark Matter Digital Network, was built solely for the purpose of Art coming back, which he did now for a couple of months. And so I was the longest running live show on that network, and we have 1 week left. I'm going out with a bang, though. I have James Fox on. I'm really excited to have him on. But so Art is
done.
He's out. He's done. And you know, there's a lot of talk about that, how it happened. I don't know if you've looked into that at all.
I have not seen a whole lot of the talk. I did speak, you know, Lee and Spiegel and I speak often, and we talked about it a bit this weekend because as soon as I saw your post, I sent it to him. I knew he'd be shocked. He had written about how Art Bell was coming back. And the whole thing, all of this has been so strange for the last couple of years because, of course, he came back to XM. Everybody was really excited about him going to XM. Shortly after he started on XM, that fell through. Then the Dark Matter Radio Network came into existence. And, of course, I kept calling it the Art Bell Dark Matter Radio Network. Then I was told, oh, we can't call it that because he's under contract. So it's just the Dark Matter Digital Network. And because he couldn't come back on the air till his XM contract ended, and then that ended, and you know, people waited maybe a year to hear him come back online again. He came back online. He's only been up for a few months, and what was the strangest, it's not like, hey guys, I'm going to retire. It was, I'm retiring. I'm not going to be on the air tonight or ever again.
That's right. Yep.
Whoa.
It all had to do with a supposed stalker, and that fired gunshots. He's saying, you know, he doesn't want me to run the show. That's what Art is getting out of it, which I don't know. It's pretty bizarre.
Yeah, really weird stuff. Of course, I've heard and seen some conspiracy theories out there that, you know, there was no stalker, there is a stalker, there's evidence there's no stalker, there's who knows what's going on. But obviously, I think from given the past that Art Bell is quick to I can't say I'm too surprised, because even originally when he came on the air, I guess I was hopeful because it was going to be an XM show. But once he left, it was like, you know, it seemed like he just wasn't ready or willing to come back. Of course, people will remember when his last appearances on Coast to Coast AM, which of course he did found. And he kind of came back and left, and then left for good. And it was kind of the same thing. It was like he just didn't seem like he wanted to come back, but was maybe coaxed into it because people love him and missed him. So, but he always seemed kind of reticent to really put his whole heart back into the whole thing. And now, boom, out of nowhere, it's done. But the unfortunate part, of course, is that there's a whole network that has built on this where, you know, Bill and Nancy Burns, I've been on their show. They're great people. They have a popular show on the network. Dr. J, you, others. And so now, unfortunately, the fallout is the whole network is going away, huh?
Well, according to – now, I haven't spoke to Keith, the producer, which I'm kind of surprised, but I've been trying to reach him, and I haven't had any return calls. However, he is posting up on the website that they're going to give the run at least 30 days. Now, Heather, his producer, has taken over the shows, and she's going to be interviewing the people. But I've seen some angry comments about that, people saying, you know, I'm not going to pay to hear Heather in the desert. I want to pay to hear Art and, you know, Midnight in the Desert. So I don't know. You know, I think he's given it 1 month. He's giving the live shows 1 week, and then the entire network he's going to give 1 month to see how it goes. And this is all I'm reading. Now, I haven't spoke to Keith, like I said, but this is all what he's posting out there on the Internet and on Facebook.
Hmm. Yeah, so I guess even all of you guys on the network are in the dark a bit, huh?
We are. Yep.
Well, I guess, you know, all I could say is it's unfortunate Art's not going to be on the air. It's unfortunate the network's going away, because it was turning into it's developed into a great network with some great shows. And all I can say is, I guess I think I am grateful that they ran our show on the network. You know, here and there they would download our shows and air them. So that's cool.
That's right. I do want to say one thing, though. Mm-hmm. I would like to announce here, people that do listen to my show on occasion, that like to listen live, I have a number of listeners live, you know, every single week. So I would hope that we're going to be able to migrate at least some of these people. I'm going to have a live feed right on my website, Podcast UFO, and still run the show's chat room and everything live at the same time, which is Wednesday nights at 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. I'm going to run the show live at the same time, and then if Keith wants to run my show pre-recorded, he's going to have to pick a different time slot.
Okay. Okay, cool. So podcastufo.com is where you'll still be able to hear Podcast UFO.
Yep, in about a week's time, I should have the live feed up, and the whole thing will be right there. All they have to do is you just click on a link during the that time period, and the live show will come up.
Nice, which live is nice because then you get to take callers and stuff like that.
Yeah, it's a bit of a challenge. There's some technical challenges sometimes, but I love doing a live show, and I don't want to go back to a podcast. I do already do another podcast on the antiques, and that's enough for me.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha. Yeah, so I'm just a one man. So are you. I'm just too busy. It's so difficult to do a live show, and quite frankly, it's hard to take calls because. You know, sometimes you get some really odd stuff in it, and it gets difficult. But yeah, so there
that's
you go.
Right.
Well, that's big news. That's crazy. That's really wild stuff. Wild stuff.
Yeah, I know if you Google online Art Bell retiring, it comes up about five times and all the different times that he's like thrown in the towel. So it's not a surprise. And as a matter of fact, on August 21st, when he had what he said his neighbors were reporting gunshots outside of his studio, which he didn't hear because he was in his studio, be interested to see if there's a police report about that. But during that time, I had a listener text me and said, well, I give Art Bell a couple of weeks now. And so I said, why? And then she told me about the supposed stalker, and she said, that's just his cue. He's on his way out. I thought that was kind
really?
Of interesting insight, but, you know, just a speculative one.
That is interesting, and that person turned out to be right.
Yes, so, that's right.
This is, you know, I don't think we've talked about this, you know, migrating over to UFO news, is that Roger Marsh, who, of course, reports MUFON Director of Communication, who is posting stories every day at openminds.tv, he posted a story about a sighting in Pahrump, Nevada, which is where Art Bell is. Art Bell is in the middle of the desert. So, you know, I live mm-hmm. in a desert, and not that I'm in a rural area, but gunshots, I guess, aren't too abnormal, especially when you're out in the desert or and where he is, out in the middle of the desert in Pahrump, Nevada. But there was a UFO sighting, a UFO video even submitted to MUFON that we recently posted a story about. The sighting took place on July 12th, 2014 at 9 p.m. And this person said they saw a dark object that appeared to be very large, hovering and then moving at times. They filmed for about half an hour before it got too dark to see this object. And when you see the video, the video itself, I'll warn you, is not very impressive. You couldn't really see much. But they said there were different lights on the object, and it had sat there for a long period of time, and they understand that unfortunately their phone didn't pick it up very well. But they said that the object made no noise. There were flashing lights of white, green, and red on the object. And their quote here, I think their best quote from the report was, "We are not claiming this object is extraterrestrial, but it's definitely by all definition a UFO. If you witnessed what we saw, you would have been in awe like we were. I looked for any logical explanation to what we were witnessing before putting this out there for us to be ridiculed." So I like that sentence because it shows that this witness is, understood that they would be ridiculed, and that they wanted to, before they posted a report, do everything they could to try to identify what it was. So, yeah, an interesting mm-hmm. report from Art Bell Land.
That's right. That town isn't – I don't think it's a highly populated either. I'm not really sure.
No,
but,
let's see. I think usually Roger put some stats in here. Let's see. He says that it has a population – oh, it's in Nye County, and the entire county
right.
– has 36,441 people.
Ah, the size of a medium-sized city.
Yeah, exactly. So.
Or a smaller city, I guess.
Yeah, it just yeah. goes to show you how little there is out there in Pahrump, where Art Bell was broadcasting up until recently.
That's right. Nice equipment. I should ask him if I could buy it at his yard sale.
Mm-hmm. You know what I should say, too, is that I have been, a lot of people say, oh, you should get him to the UFO Congress, and every year they tell us that, and we have tried. We have really tried hard. You mentioned Keith, the producer. He tried to help us get Art Bell, but Art Bell just does not, just like, of course, Jacques Vallée is the same way. He does not do UFO conferences, doesn't like doing them. Refuses to do them, will not do them under any circumstance, which is the same response I kept getting from Vallée for years. But luckily we are having him, you know, at the next conference. But yeah, Art Bell just has no interest in going to a UFO conference or being part of one, unfortunately. Feel free to email him and tell him, hey, come to the UFO Congress, because we would absolutely love to have him, and we have tried.
Yeah, and you have that space still open for one more guest, right?
No.
Oh, you got it filled. Okay.
I've already told. We talked about that. Remember?
Not really. I thought you still.
Oh my gosh, you're getting old, buddy.
No.
We talked about how I have a really exciting special guest slated for that period of time, the one open time. We don't have it all the everything signed and back, but we've got a confirmation, and it's going to be. I'm glad you brought the spot up because it's going to be super exciting. It's one of my all-time heroes. But yeah, so we've got someone for that spot. You don't remember this at all?
I do remember. You're talking about the guest, but I didn't realize that he filled the spot.
Yeah.
That was open.
Yeah.
Okay. So we just had a little communication gap. That's all, buddy.
Yeah. And another sighting that I think is kind of interesting, an interesting photograph. It was from Canada. And you almost sound like you have a bit of a Canadian accent. Anybody ever told you that?
Poser. No, I didn't realize I had much of a New England accent because I've lived at different parts of the country, but I'm sure it's, most of my life was in New England, so I'm sure I do sound a little bit hoser-like.
Mm-hmm. You sound
Canadian.
Like a complete hoser.
Yeah. Well. Now I'm a homeless hoser.
That's not a bad thing. The guy I'm interviewing in a minute here, Dave Cote, is from Vancouver. That's where he is right now. In fact, we just got done with the interview a little while ago, and that we'll include here. So it's by no means a put down. It's just an observation that, I was thinking earlier today, and maybe I'm mixing it up with New England or something, but yeah, a little Canadian-ish. Canadian-esque.
Yeah,
so that's a good thing, buddy. But this is a Canadian witness who videotaped a low-flying military airplane. And the reason why is they saw what they said was a silver disc UFO. They took a photo of it and this military plane above it. And the photo is very interesting. They tried to videotape this as well and didn't get much but the plane. But they feel that the videotape shows the plane flying around strangely. It does look to be possibly fairly low. I'm not sure if it's flying necessarily that oddly, but you can take a look. But the photo is very interesting. I guess it's possible it's a bird where its wings are just in the right space where you can't see them. And the sun is reflecting, but it does look like a reflective object. So the photo is really odd. It's a very, very interesting photo. I do kind of question, unfortunately, the witness's perception of size. He said the military craft was huge and was the size of a city block.
What? The military craft?
Yeah.
Yeah, a little perspective off there.
Yeah, I think they're a little off. I think when people see the plane, they'll be able to identify what type it is. And it does look to be, the size of a commercial aircraft probably. But that's not necessarily the size of an entire city block. So I think
it could be a Pahrump, Nevada city block.
Yeah, that's a good point. You're right. It could be Pahrump, Nevada. And this person, might not be familiar with, larger city
now,
blocks.
I have a friend that's a fellow appraiser up in Toronto, and he said he saw, it was kind of a similar sighting, except he's facing a disc, and he has nothing. He is not into the topic of UFOs at all. We just had a conversation one day.
Oh, he saw a disc. Where was he?
He was in Toronto.
Oh, wow.
And he was at a party and a bunch of people out on his back deck, and they heard the jets and they looked up and they saw these two jets chasing a silver disc.
Wow.
And he was totally shocked. The next day, everybody was looking at each other and, they called, no one knew anything, and then they watched a bunch of him and his friends watch for a few days to see if it would come out in the newspapers, and it never did. And that was his one and only encounter. But he doesn't think the talk of UFOs is crazy. He's one of these people that kind of accepts it after seeing that.
Wow, that's really cool. Yeah, in fact, that reminds me of David Cote, who we're talking to in a minute. He had a really interesting sighting, too, that got him into all of this. And he was a real big skeptic. So pretty cool. Wow, that's interesting. So people can check out the video of the plane, estimate the size for yourselves, and look at the photo and see if you think it's something interesting. Of course, you can find that all at openminds.tv. So otherwise, you know, you had the most exciting news, most interesting, I think, with this Art Bell incident. So
yeah, weird. Unfortunately, yeah.
Yeah, so, but you're going to be fine. You know what? You're going to be fine, buddy.
Yep.
Hey, keep your chin up. You're a good guy.
I will,
man.
You got a good show. Thanks, man.
Yeah. What? There's a pause there. Were you sobbing?
No, it's our internet connection. I'm sorry.
Oh, okay. I thought maybe you were getting emotional. So. But you're not too concerned, though, right? You're not freaking out.
No. It'll, like you said, it'll be fine. And again, if anyone's interested, they still want to listen to the show live, they can just check it out on my website in about 2 weeks from now.
All right, cool. Well, thank you so much for joining us again, Martin.
Thanks. It's always a pleasure.
And even though you're not really homeless, you've lost a home, but you've got a mansion that you normally, you lost a vacation home, but you've got your
that's right,
your B&B that you live in, a beautiful home that, and you're going to be fine.
Yeah, thanks, man.
All right. Okay, so that's it for the news. Let's go ahead and talk with Dave Cote. I am very happy to be joined by David Cote. Hello.
Hi, how are you?
Good, doing pretty good. So, and so people know if you cough here or there, I guess you've got a bit of a cold, huh?
I do, yes. I've got that little bit of a winter bug.
Yeah, unfortunately. And yeah. Where are you at?
I'm in Vancouver, Canada.
Oh, okay, great. So kind of chilly out there probably, huh?
It's not freezing yet. It's about 5 or 6 degrees, so it's not too bad.
Okay, good. So you're doing something really exciting. You have your CubeSat for Disclosure,
yes.
Your crowdsourcing, and maybe, I guess to begin with, if you can kind of describe what a CubeSat is.
Okay, it's a small square device. It's basically, imagine a cube of circuit boards, and it has various instruments like a camera or two, antennas so that you can uplink, downlink, and it is sent into orbit, low Earth orbit, where it stays for a few months, and after which it burns up in the atmosphere, that therefore there's no space junk floating out there. And it'll allow us to kind of circle the globe and take measurements of things like radiation and pictures to go along with it. We're also hoping for some other really cool things like passive infrareds, maybe passive radar, if we can figure that one out. And we're basically going to take the ground observation to the next level into low Earth orbit and try to capture some phenomenon.
That's pretty exciting. And I think the CubeSat project or program is pretty new, isn't it, where it allows pretty much anyone to put one of these little guys up in space?
Yeah, I think it's, I mean, possibly this might be the first year that they're doing like purely private launches. There's like the company I've been talking to, Interorbital Systems, they will do a very simple, what's called a CubeSat. It's even smaller, and they'll give you a launch for $8,000 along with a little kit, and you got to build it yourself. So we're trying to go a level up from that and do a CubeSat, which allows more weight, more instrumentation. It's a little more pricey. But I've actually found out some new information that there are companies that will do free launches. And so we're kind of fielding that a little bit. If we could get a free launch, then we could put all the money towards instruments, and that would be great.
Wow, that's pretty cool. So are they doing free launches for, like, you have to apply kind of a grant type of thing, or?
I think how it works is you have commercial companies like, you know, SpaceX, NASA, various others. They will do a launch for a very big payload, but usually they've got a lot of extra space. So they don't use up their full payload. So what they end up doing is just packing some junk in there to make the weight kind of even out. And they'd much prefer to send up people's little experiments. And in these ways, you can apply. I know a lot of students do. And if you've got an interesting experiment, they're more than happy to bring it on up.
How cool.
Yeah.
That's really cool. So since these CubeSats, are unpowered, or at least, you know, no propulsion type of system on there, do they eventually then their orbit deteriorates and they burn up in the atmosphere?
That's correct, yeah. So they just kind of go around depending on the space weather. If there's a lot of solar flares happening, you could end up with just a few weeks, you know, 3 or 4 weeks even.
Oh, really?
Yeah, but hopefully you'd get up to 2 or 3 months, and that's more. I think the average is about 2 months.
Oh, really? So the life of your system, best case scenario, will be 2-3 months.
Yeah, unless it keeps going. Like if we get good results and we get more interest, then we could make it a regular thing. And then we could think in the future of trying to get a higher orbit. Of course, we'd have to pass all the regulations and such. I know you can get a small, it basically ejects pressurized water or something, and it will sort of keep your boosting the satellite up just a tad to keep it in orbit longer. But of course, to have those things, you need to pass various regulations, because they don't want an accident where you, next thing you're, satellites flying into the space station or something, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I guess your satellite, in order to, what equipment is on it will probably be dependent on how much money you're able to raise, I'd guess.
That's correct, yeah. Mm-hmm. Like some of the things we think we will get for sure are the cameras. There, even the camera we have listed, which we are hoping to get, there are cheaper ways to go. Like, as you know, every smartphone has a pretty decent camera these days, and the CMOS detectors are getting really big. So we'll definitely be able to get one or two cameras on there. And then there's the radiation, the scintillation counter, which basically picks up ionized radiation. And we'd like to find a way that it's picks it up not just on a directional basis, but picks it up all around the cube, basically.
Mm-hmm.
Then there's things such as infrared, like full spectrum. We'd like to get that. We found a few interesting ways that we should be able to capture that. And then finally, there's radar, which has never really been done on a little satellite like that. Generally, a radar system is really expensive and quite big. But we may be able to do something where it passively picks it up, and then that would allow us to pick up a little bit of radar.
With the scintillation counter, how close does an object need to be? Is it going to be difficult to pick up radiation, or I guess, you know, from an anomalous object, for instance?
It shouldn't be too hard. I mean, distance isn't such a big factor. Like, these are ionized particles, so they're shooting really fast, great distances, so we should be able to pick it up no problem. Imagine in the movies you'll see someone has a little radiation detector and they're trying to see if an area is radioactive or dangerous, and you'll hear little click sounds, and that's when it's picking it up. It's basically like that, so it would pick it up. I think our range would be quite decent, at least to the point where if it's picking it up, then we'd turn our imaging on and be able to capture it.
Mm-hmm. Will the imaging, will the cameras always be on?
That, I don't think so. I mean, if we were to go video stream, the data consumption would be ridiculous.
Mm.
There may be an option to do streaming if we kind of do a series of very fast still images, which is basically what video really is. And we could extract the thumbnail of each one, which is a tiny, tiny image, and stream that. You wouldn't get the same resolution, but then what we could do is do an image comparison. And when there's an amount of light picking up on one of the frames, we could switch to the higher resolution. So we could go from, you know, 100 kilobytes per image and then jump that up to a couple megabytes per image.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. So even, well, depending on your compression, those could be pretty good images then. Those could be pretty high quality.
Definitely, yeah. And there's a few options for data. One that I think would be the best is if we stay on the ham radio frequencies, and what that would do is it would allow anyone with a ham radio to pick up certain parts of the data. That would fully kind of open source it, right?
Mm-hmm.
But the problem with the ham radio frequencies is it's such a slow download. Like, a lot of times they'll use kind of Morse code or possibly hex, but it's a lot slower than even the slowest Wi-Fi we have on Earth.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So how much data will you be able to retrieve then? Even if you put cameras on it, will you be able to get much in the way of video?
Streaming video, probably not. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, still imagery, what we're hoping is that we'll have some algorithms pick up on data that would show motion detection, radar detection, infrared detection. When it does detect an anomaly is when the imagery would turn on. Mm-hmm. So the only real data consumption would be at those times. And unless we have, you know, thousands of UFOs at all times, then we should be okay mm-hmm. to capture, you know, a few events.
That's pretty cool. And, the other good thing about this is it's kind of an experiment where you and everyone else is able to learn from what you do to see what works and what doesn't for future projects.
Exactly. And, I mean, it's not limited to the UFO phenomenon. If we discover anything at all that's new or interesting, it could lead to, you know, publishing scientific papers, even like something to do with magnetic field of Earth or solar flares or solar radiation, that kind of thing. That's just a bonus. I mean, anything newly discovered would be a bonus.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so fun. I mean, I think it's really super exciting. I got to visit Johnson Space Center recently, and so it's like, you know, thinking of all the stuff in space and the people who have gone there or will be going there, seeing all of this equipment that has or will be going there, and to be mm-hmm. able to, you know, be viewing these pictures from, you know, a private satellite, that's just so exciting.
It's pretty cool, yeah. Mm-hmm. I was very surprised that this hasn't been done before. I mean, I was kind of just reading through the literature one day, and I thought, I mean, there's so many pictures, images, witness testimonies of UFOs or unexplained phenomenon. And then I thought, you know, why didn't we send a satellite up, and has that been done? And I found it hadn't been done. So, I mean, the next logical step in experimenting would be to send something up there and try to get something that's scientifically verifiable or disputable, right?
Mm-hmm. So in your verbiage, CubeSat for disclosure, did you purposefully avoid using the word UFO? And if so, why?
Well, I think I may have, I mean, I didn't really think explicitly I don't want to use the word UFO, but I think I may have just intuitively left it out, because unidentified, it basically just means you don't know what it is, right? Mm-hmm. And this is more geared towards, we want to know what it is, basically.
Mm-hmm.
So by getting data that is verifiable, hopefully close up, we should be able to verify like what this is, whether it be is this just a meteorite or a meteor? Is this a solar flare? Or is this actually a craft? Which mm-hmm. we should be able to make out.
That is a really interesting thought, actually. It's kind of, you know, you don't want to capture a UFO, which by definition is unidentified,
yeah, exactly.
Which then is something you can never identify. What good is that? You want to capture data to hopefully identify, even if it's this thing, even if it's anomalous.
Yeah, and it's, I mean, it's kind of a topic that, like a lot of scientists don't want to touch. It's interesting. Mm-hmm. Early on, I had someone who was a CubeSat specialist, and they were really excited to get involved, and you know, we're sending a CubeSat up, and they were doing their thesis on CubeSat optimization, and like we talked about the whole ETI UFO thing, and that was fine, but once it got on to CHCH News in Toronto, they dropped out. Because they were worried about, I guess, the repercussions of colleagues and what people would say, just because of the phenomena. Like, I mean, people send experiments all the time measuring all kinds of things, but once you put the word UFO in there or extraterrestrial, and it seems to bring with it some ridicule. And I don't know where that has come from. I don't know if that was staged from way back in the 40s and 50s, if it was, you know, government initiated to make it ridiculous.
Yeah, and it's you know, so I mean, these guys and credibility is so important to them that unfortunately, you know, there's so many different cases where people I've talked to, and unfortunately, the most credible people, even the different scientific organizations that are open to looking into the phenomena, many of them will want to remain anonymous because they just don't want that stigma tied to them, and which is frustrating because all it is it's investigating the unknown, which really is what science is.
Yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm. So numbers, it looks like, you know, about what is it going to cost? It sounds like your costs have gone down or potentially will if you don't have to pay for the launch. So what do the numbers look like? How much do you need to get one of these little guys up there?
Well, the very smallest experiment, which would be this small CubeSat, I believe it allows a payload of an additional payload of 250 grams, very small. We can get the kit for that and the launch from Interorbital Systems for 8,000 US. We're basically like we have that covered now. So we've got our worst case scenario set up that would probably allow purely imagery, nothing else.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, that's so we know we're going to be launching something, that's for sure. We're at the like around the 12,000 mark. So I mean, our 8,000 for the kit, the launch, and then the goodies we have to send out, like the T-shirts. I think we've got that covered already. We've got close to another month left of the campaign. Plus, it's an in-demand campaign, which means funds can be received afterwards if we're like very short of reaching a goal for a CubeSat to be sent, for instance. And I've recently learned from a fellow who just joined the team, Matt Lippert. He works as a CubeSat optimization specialist and electrical engineer, and he's looking into the free launch opportunities. And in this case, we could end up getting a whole bunch of instruments, because if we put the 8,000 that was to the launch straight to the Cube, we can do a lot more cool things with it.
Mm-hmm. And by the way, I guess, what size is the Cube?
Oh, the dimensions, it's like 10 centimeters by 10 centimeters by 10 centimeters, basically.
Okay, cool. So you chose to crowdsource this, and you're using Indiegogo, which is important because everybody knows about Kickstarter. That's probably the most popular crowdsourcing tool. But yeah. If you don't reach your goal, you don't get any of the money.
That's right. Yeah. I'll
whereas with Indiegogo, right, even if you don't meet your goal, you'll receive what you've been pledged thus far.
Yeah. Well, they have a couple different ways to do it. Like you can choose that if you don't reach your goal, funds just get refunded, or you can choose that if you don't reach your goal, you get the funds. I guess if you didn't reach your goal and you just want it all refunded, that would be where you actually needed a certain amount of capital. And if you don't have that amount, you just can't do it, basically.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas we knew that if we just hit the 8,000 mark, we'd at least have a launch. Anything more just gives us a better tool to put up there. And if we didn't reach the 8,000, I was prepared myself to just probably kick the rest of the money in to do it.
Mm-hmm. One, this is what's awesome, is that, you know, your goal is 50,000. We'll talk about what you hope that would achieve you if you do reach that goal, which you may, because you've already gotten 23% of your goal. Like you said, you've got about almost $12,000, and you still have 24 days left.
Exactly. And if I can hustle on the PR and the coverage, then you never know.
Mm-hmm. So how has the campaign gone? It seems to be a success.
Yeah, it's amazing. Like, it's actually kind of surprised me. Initially, when I had the idea, I was reading some articles about private satellite launches, and I came across Interorbital's deal there. And I reached out to a few colleagues and said, you know, why don't we do this? They're very science-minded anyway, and they'd love to help send a satellite up just for any reason. And they were interested, but one of them said, you know, why don't you set up a crowdfunding and then I'll help you promote it. And it hadn't occurred to me to do that. And I thought, sure, that sounds like a good idea. So I started, you know, shooting a little video and putting it together. And next thing, I had news agencies contacting me wanting to interview. And that's when the funds started rolling in. And yeah, I'd say it was an amazing success.
Mm-hmm.
I'm surprised. I'm very happy with it.
Well, that's really cool, too. That's a neat story that you hadn't even thought of it, or you weren't going to do that. And thank goodness you have, because, you know, your options increase. And it's something that's exciting that really, you know, you shouldn't have to foot all the bill.
Yeah, exactly. And I think this way, more people become involved. It makes it more of an open source project.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
I've learned a lot along the way, like Matt Lippert, who joined on recently, he has access to all the testing facilities, whereas before we were kind of make the hardiest little CubeSat we could, but we didn't have the proper testing facilities, so, you know, something could have gone wrong and we just have a dead satellite up there, whereas now we've got this fellow on board who has all the testing facilities, he can do the vibration tests, etc. So we're kind of guaranteed that it's going to actually work once it gets up there, and that's a great thing.
Right. I mean, and some of that, and that's another aspect. How successful has it been in attracting people to help you? Because some of these resources like that one, that's, you know, savings that go beyond even your goal, possibly.
Yeah, exactly. And it's, I mean, I couldn't have gotten any of that without the Indiegogo project, so it's mm-hmm. very good.
And have you had a great response with people saying, hey, I want to help out?
Yeah, it's been pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I have a few people who exceeded 1,000 in their contribution, and I've had a heck of a lot of people who will just put in like 10 or 20 bucks, mm-hmm. 30 bucks.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and it seems like your team has grown. If I remember correctly, when I first looked at this, you only had maybe 3 people on there. Now there's 6.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And
we've had one or two actually drop out, and that was because of the UFO topic and the media coverage.
Mm.
But at the same time that happened, I had people come forward that wanted to be involved, and so I would talk to them. And Pat Regan is one of the fellows who I took onto the team because he's got a lot of experience writing for the UFO phenomenon. And then Matthew Lippert, he's got an amazing resume when it comes to satellites. So of course I wanted to get him involved as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's awesome because, he's a CubeSat specialist.
Yeah. And he has successful launches under his belt. So, I mean, that's what you want, right?
Really awesome. That is so cool. Yeah. Someone with experience. Well, that's really exciting. So when it comes to the $50,000 number, you were probably thinking, best case scenario, this is what I would love to do, I'm guessing. And what were you hoping then that would fund?
Well, initially, and that's the data that's actually still up on the site. Mm-hmm. I've got a list for all the expenses on there, and that would be the full $50,000. So there's your CubeSat kit with launch, and that would be just under $20,000, actually $19,625. And then we had a NanoCam C1U, and that would be $9,000. And then we'd have a scintillation counter that was close to $5,000. And then you've got your downlink and your uplink, and that's going to be between $10,000 and $12,000. And then you've got about $5,000 for a deployable antenna system. That was originally what I was aiming for. Of course, now there's a lot of options have come forward, like our cameras are going to possibly be a lot cheaper, as well as the launch. I mean, if we could end up getting a free launch right there, that saves us $20,000 that we can put towards better instruments, right?
Mm-hmm.
And if we get a free launch as well, we get that much extra, we could inquire about getting a higher orbit. That would give us a longer orbit time to be able to take our data to.
Mm-hmm. Deployable antenna, does that mean that's something that pops out once it gets up there?
Yeah, generally it's kind of like if you think of those little tool belts, measuring tapes, and the way if you bend it and you let go, it just kind of snaps straight.
Mm-hmm.
It would kind of do that once it ejects out of the tube, the antenna kind of just bops straight.
Cool. So interesting. It's a really cool plan. Now, you also include towards the end then your justification for why you feel, you know, it's a good idea to hunt UFOs essentially. And I guess, what was your interest? Have you always been interested in the topic?
No, I actually was a pretty huge skeptic up until a few years ago. I mean, of course it's interesting, but people would tell me they've seen this and they've seen that, and I just kind of go like, wow, I mean, I've never seen anything, and it would take a lot for me to believe in such a thing. I even had a director friend from LA, and he'd moved to Vancouver, and we worked on some projects, and he was really big. He'd always talk about the alien technology he's seen in the desert and all this stuff, and he was a good friend. And he was very trustworthy, but I still said, like, I'd need some really strong proof to believe those words, unfortunately. And then what happened was a high school friend of mine started sending me emails about UFO stuff and this and that, and I kind of just kept responding with skepticism and, you know, shutting him down. And then he just phoned me, and I hadn't talked to him in quite a while, and I was good to talk to you, Jay. Let's catch up. And he said, it's like, some of these things I'm sending you. And I'm like, yeah, I know. I'm kind of skeptical. I apologize for that. And then he said, do you want to see these things? And I kind of just, you know, didn't know how to respond to that. And he then took me close to where I live out to Mission. And there's a lake there. And we went there at night, and we just kind of sat looking up at the sky. And he explained to me that he had a very big sighting off the coast of California. I believe it was 2008, maybe 2010, where he saw a craft that was gigantic in the daylight. It appeared, it stopped traffic. Some people were screaming in terror. Like it was kind of a traumatic event, apparently.
Really? Wow.
Yeah. And he said, like, ever since he was in touch with MUFON and everyone else. And he said, ever since that day, anytime he goes looking at night, he sees something. He seemed to think maybe they were in tune to him or something. I don't know. So I went with him, and we're sitting under the stars, and I'm feeling a little bit creeped out, and you know, this is strange. I know him and his story. I can't see why he would just make something up. And all of a sudden, these lights appeared above us, and there was a couple little orbs hovering and then zigging and zagging and moving around, and this is before the time of drones, and it was not helicopters, it was not planes. I racked my brain to try to think, is it possible that some falling stars were somehow just hitting in the exact same spot, and it just didn't make sense. So I kind of concluded with my inquisitive mind that, you know, what I saw was unexplainable, and these things looked very intelligently controlled.
Hmm.
And that kind of crushed my skepticism, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Wow, that's an amazing sighting.
Yeah, it was crazy. It was really crazy. And I ended up telling all my friends, and I was really excited for probably 6 months. I took some of my friends out. We had more sightings. And then my excitement just kind of went into the background because we see these things, but, you know, what can you do about that?
Right.
Maybe it's alien craft, but what can you do about that, right?
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
And then that's when recently I had this idea, well, why don't we try to study it and get some actual scientific evidence to back it up? That'd be really cool.
Mm-hmm. Did that then, your sighting, I'm guessing, spawned your interest, and then it appears, given the links that you have in the Indiegogo campaign, that you also did some research, because unfortunately, some of the links, for instance, that you gave, you have to kind of do some research to find this information out, because it's not like readily right. available so much.
That's right. Yeah, I did. I definitely started reading about it more, and it's interesting because there's a heck of a lot of evidence that there's extraterrestrial visitation going on, and the evidence comes in the form of visual, video, photograph. But a large part of this evidence comes from testimony from highly credible people. Like I'm in Canada, and our last defense minister, once he retired, he came forward and said he has knowledge that, you know, there's aliens visiting our planet. And that's a pretty huge thing to say. But then there's also oodles of ex-Air Force employees, ex-military, people who worked at nuclear facilities, and they all say they've had sightings. They have knowledge of this technology. It's not just solar flares. It's not just weather. It's actually, you know, other beings that are flying around in our atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, there's a lot of stuff out there. And after doing my research, I found that there's a compelling amount of evidence. And it's strange, actually, that it's not accepted mainstream, or at least investigated, because I mean, if it's true that there's alien craft flying around our planet, and I think that's important, I think that the technology involved would be probably enough to clean up our own planet, probably some very efficient types of energy that could help us. I mean, we just had the climate deal in Paris. Like, we need something to replace the coal, right?
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I think it's an important topic.
Mm-hmm. It looks like your crew is younger. Certainly, the original group put together, and even Matthew Lippert are maybe in their 20s. Would that be about accurate?
Yeah, Pat Regan's a little older than that.
Yeah.
But yeah, we're all generally pretty young.
And the reason I ask is because do you feel that younger people, or your generation, or maybe even the generation behind you, are more open to this topic?
Yeah, it definitely could be the case. I mean, Steven Spielberg, one of my favorite directors, he very obviously has a huge interest in this, and people in my age range have grown up with his movies. I'm sure you've grown up with his movies.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of in the media consciousness. It's been like for my whole life, the interest in the extraterrestrial issue or the UFO phenomenon. And I guess maybe back in the 40s and 50s, it was more of a scary thing. I mean, they were dealing with world wars and bombs coming and some really scary things. And then sightings would lead to, you know, panic, possibly hysteria. There was that radio show. Do you remember that? And they
War of the Worlds.
Yeah, and they staged that, and some people actually like freaked out, and I think there was deaths involved. So I think back then maybe it was a very scary topic, and no one had ever really thought about it or explored the possibility of it. Whereas today, maybe we have a more open mind to it. Like they're finding evidence of water on Mars. They're, you know, saying that it's very likely we're going to come across some bacteria very soon in space. And maybe it's just making more sense to people that these things are out there, probably have been out there for a very long time.
Mm-hmm.
And doesn't mean we have to lose our minds or lose our cool. We could study it and be interested in it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's funny you say that, and especially right now, because this Christmas, you know, I've grown up, essentially Star Wars, I was, you know, a little kid when the first one came up and out, so I've had it in my whole life, let alone all the other stuff. But this year, more than any year, is like the Christmas of Star Wars, with the new movie coming out and everything. And it's just kind of funny that this dichotomy of where we grow up watching and, you know, suspending our belief in our imagination and interacting with these alien civilizations on a regular basis in the entertainment industry. Yet, when it comes to real life, even the consideration, it can be taboo.
Yeah, exactly. It's interesting.
Mm-hmm. So it gets kind of strange that way. And even Spielberg himself, like you had mentioned, who I also am a huge fan, and I follow all of his, anytime he makes any comment, and he's made more comments in the last, let's say, 5 years about UFOs and his interest than he had at any time, because he also is reticent to make that admission or even go there. And I guess, unfortunately, you know, we haven't got to interview him about it, but I'm guessing it's because of the fear of ridicule.
Could be, and isn't he, I think I had heard somewhere or from a friend, he was a religious person. I mean, maybe not extremely, but I think grew up maybe with Catholicism.
I thought he was Jewish.
Oh, sorry. I must be thinking of a different director. Who am I thinking?
So I'm not sure how religious he is, but that's another interesting question.
Yeah. I can't remember. I can't place which director me and my friend were talking about. I thought it was Spielberg.
Maybe someone like De Palma, because he's done a UFO movie or two, I believe.
But anyway, my thoughts were going to go along the lines of how religions themselves on Earth, like, used to be very non-accepting of the concept of extraterrestrial things. But I mean, today the whole view on it has changed. The Vatican scientists are talking about it. It's not such a taboo thing in the mainstream religions. So just like that in the mainstream media, it used to be very taboo. Now it seems more and more they're actually airing. Like, I mean, I just had an interview on this project with Toronto News 20 years ago. I don't know if they would have done that same interview, right?
Mm-hmm. How have your interviews gone? Has there been a lot of tongue-in-cheek, or has it been surprisingly straightforward? How has it gone?
It has gone actually surprisingly straightforward. If you check out the footage on the Toronto News there, when they first introduced me, they both got a smirk on. But then the fellow interviewing me, he's asking just very straightforward, very real questions, and I felt we kind of stuck to the science of it. And then he had brought up a bunch of sightings. Like there was a recent one here in, I think, Manitoba, where it was thought that something crashed. And there's all kinds of sightings. Like it seems to be kind of a regular occurrence on the news these days. Mm-hmm. Like there was the Chicago O'Hare Airport one in, I think, 2004 or something. You remember that?
Yeah, 2008. That was a...
2008, right.
That's a great one. Uh-huh.
That was crazy. I mean, you have staff members and pilots saying they saw this disc shoot up into the clouds from the airport. And then, yeah, they covered it. I don't think they got much backlash, but then people forget about it.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. And you know, no one's explained that one. That's an incredible case, a really good one. And you know what's funny? I don't know if you've ran into this at all yet, because certainly I've done tons and tons of these media interviews, and I would say about 70% will play the X-Files music, and that gets really tiresome. You know, actually, the second time it happens, it gets tiresome. But then they do it again every time, and they think they're so original. But have you ran across that?
I don't know if I quite understand, like, how
where they've kind of been tongue in cheek, or the entire interview.
Actually, no. Surprisingly,
that's
no.
Good.
Yeah, I mean, I had a colleague of mine, my press guy Mark, did an interview. I think he came on right after you, actually, on podcast UFO.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I'm pretty sure yours was right before his, but I was sick. I mean, I've had this cold. It was pretty nasty a week ago, and he did an interview, and he didn't have many of the answers. So in the interview, I think it was very tough. A couple callers called in and asked some very hard scientific questions, and he was kind of baffled and fumbling, and I felt really bad. But the interviewer never said anything ridiculous, or never ridiculed his story at all. Took him very seriously, and then afterwards I just sent an email, and I said, for the answers that Mark didn't have, here, I'll just give you a quick spiel on it. But no, it was never tongue-in-cheek at all. Like, I mean, podcast UFO, obviously their interest is UFO, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I haven't had any of that yet where, you know, anyone's trying to make fun of it, or, and I'm happy about that. It's good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's really good. And what I hope, I mean, it seems like, you know, the topic is out there so much that, and this is where I feel, you know, I've said this for years, and unfortunately there's not been an organization to fulfill this role. But I think UFOs, it's ripe for an organization like the SETI of UFOs to come around. So an organization of scientists who are brave enough to take it seriously and to speak to the public, you know, and their colleagues on their level about this topic. Because when SETI came forward in that manner, really the whole idea of searching for aliens was made fun of. But now it's taken very seriously, and pretty much everything SETI does makes news, it seems.
Yeah, I think so. And I think the people who do inquire about it and study it tend to be very skeptical themselves, like me. All the time I'll have a friend say, oh, look in the sky, there's a light, and I'm usually the first to discredit it and say, no, sorry, that's an airplane, that's a helicopter, that's this, that's that. I think people really studying this stuff are very, it's important for them to have data that's provable and real, so we don't feel that, you know, we're fooling ourselves or whatever. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I myself am very skeptical, and I know a lot of our listeners or followers are also very skeptical. The average IQ, I'm the average IQ of our listeners is very high, maybe in the 150s. This audience is so extremely intelligent.
Yeah, I can see that.
I like to butter them up once in a while to
Absolutely,
keep them listening.
Yeah.
But and they're so kind and nice as well. But
generous in their donations.
But no, a lot of skeptics, which is nice too, because you know, it's important, and that's how you gain credibility and get taken seriously. And not only that, you know, that way you're taken more serious as well when you are saying, you know, when you have evidence that you feel is something that people should look at. If you're, you know, someone who's proven themselves to be careful with the information, then, you know, you'll get, I think it can only help.
Yeah, like I don't think I'd ever put anything out there with a claim unless it was 100%. I mean, I see a lot of the, I have on my news feed, you know, I have world politics and I have technology and science and physics, but I also have a UFO column. And so I get little posts of the YouTube videos from the space station. They get put up there a lot with different lightings and unexplained events. And often I smirk at them because they're very explainable. There's one on the Google, what is it? Google Street View. And there's always a little light in the sky. It's kind of, like a little kind of triangle or umbrella looking thing. And I mean, to me, that's clearly just a reflection of their little car camera as
right.
it's driving around. And that's why it shows up in so many. And
right.
For yeah. myself, yeah, to make a claim with an image, I think it would have to be no other way around it except that it was had to be something, right?
That's great, too, because I think that it's going to behoove you all to be very familiar with the numerous, like you said, NASA photos and videos that come out where people mistakenly feel a reflection or a light is something anomalous when it's not, because you'll probably be faced with the same situation.
I'm sure. Yeah.
Yep, and which is great that you all have the attitude of, you know, being careful with your data, because I think projects like yours are the sort of thing that help elevate this field.
Yeah, I mean, just imagine we do find something, and like the Google Street View images, one thing is you start to see a whole bunch of them and somebody sees the pattern, like, well, this is actually this phenomenon, not an unexplainable, and that's mm-hmm. a good thing because you explain it. But if we do find something that's extremely interesting and we can do it for, say we end up being able to do this for $20,000, then it makes it very easy for a second group to go and verify it with the same experiment. Mm-hmm. And like if you're able to open this to ham radio frequencies, then, I mean, virtually anyone can log into the data, look at it in real time and know like this is unaltered. It's coming directly from the orbit. And it just makes it a lot easier to verify things. And I mean, maybe you'll see something strange, but then the next experiment shows, oh, well, that was a top secret craft that they've kind of got up flying around. But maybe you see something massive that definitely isn't from Earth, right? You never know.
Yep. Yeah. And interestingly enough, and maybe you could speak to this, I did speak with Martin. I do often. And I guess some of the people were concerned. They felt like perhaps the radiation counter and the cameras might not have the sort of range that would make it as useful.
Right. And, I mean, I can understand there's the pros and the cons with a land-based project, as well as pros and the cons with an orbit-based project. Mm-hmm. And I wouldn't really claim that either is better. I think that both should be done, definitely. I think that any angle of experiment you can put onto something only increases the value of all the data that you have together, right?
Mm-hmm. And, you know, to think that along those lines, you know, we're all down here, people have sightings, they pull out their iPhone and try to catch an image or a video of it, the vast majority not being interesting, the small minority being something interesting, you know, that we come across interesting videos. If you could take your iPhone and put it in space in one of these satellites,
exactly.
Is it worth $2,000 or $20,000 to do that? And I think it is.
Yeah. I mean,
why not?
On the off chance, that you mm-hmm. find something. Like I'm sure you've heard of the, I think it's called the Citizens Hearing on Disclosure, mm-hmm. and they. Bunch of private individuals. One fellow actually got a very generous donation. I think it was like $1 million.
Mm-hmm.
He put the money and he got a bunch of ex-Congress people together, not actual running Congress right now, but ex-Congress, paid them $20,000 if they were willing to come and sit on this panel. And they basically did a congressional hearing with the ex-Congress people, and they explored hundreds and hundreds of witness testimonies of retired Air Force people and retired astronauts, etc. And they all had such compelling evidence that all these ex-Congress members were pretty much convinced that this is important.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you have all of this, and to not to then go and study it with scientific instruments, I think is kind of foolish, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's worth doing. It's exciting. So, yeah, we're going to have one of those guys, Merrill Cook, one of those congressmen at our
cool.
Our next conference, and he's going to talk about how he got convinced, exactly what you're saying, how he saw it. He said a lot of testimony was, he was skeptical, but some of it was compelling enough where he thought, wow, there's really something here.
It's pretty weird. I mean, it definitely is.
Mm-hmm. Well, cool. Thank you so much for coming on the show. People can go to Indiegogo. Of course, we've written a story about your project, and we've had it on our UFO report. So we've been pushing this because it's so cool and so exciting. And we'll have a link on the show. But if people just go to Indiegogo, just like it sounds, Indiegogo.com, they can look up CubeSat for disclosure. Probably can even just look up CubeSat and find you. And put in a donation. There's 24 days left, and hopefully you guys will then get what you need to. This was a question I had too, actually, now that I think about it. Did the $50,000, did that include more than one satellite?
No, it would just be one. Say we surpassed that amount and we were able to do a lot more, we could even do up to I think the maximum is a U6. CubeSat. Mm-hmm. What that is six cubes stacked on top of each other.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so then, I mean, we'd get a ridiculous amount of information if we could do that.
Yeah, there's a lot to figure out because there might be better to send those one at a time once one is...
That's true, too. Yeah, exactly.
...done, you know, from your lessons learned, make the next one better and keep continuing to go on.
I mean, if we build it, say we get a free launch, we build our CubeSat, it's got what we need on it, and there's leftover, then what we would do is just put that aside, and then as soon as the satellite burns up in orbit, we could send a second one.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it would be very cool if this became a yearly thing where we continually monitored and had our own open source of data. It would be really cool.
And what's cool, too, is it seems as though, with the addition, you're very open to input. So some of these people who have these concerns about some of the equipment you're putting on your CubeSat and they have better ideas, I'm sure you would love to hear from them.
I would, definitely.
Mm-hmm. And what is the best way for them to get a hold of you then?
The best way, you can actually just go to Indiegogo.com, search CubeSat, and you'll see the project page, and you can actually send a message through there. And what it does is it sends an anonymous message that I can then respond to. That way neither of us end up disclosing our email addresses to each other. At a later point we can decide to start to talk by email instead or phone. But I think that's the best way for strangers to first connect is just go right to the Indiegogo site, and it'll send an anonymous message, and then I can send an anonymous message back. And I've chatted with a whole bunch of people that way, and it seems to work well.
Perfect. And that also allows input from hopefully some people in the space industry or in the know who don't want to disclose their names.
Exactly. Yeah.
Perfect. Awesome. Well, thank you so much. I hope you feel better. Thank you so much for making the time to come on the show.
No worries. Thank you so much for having me on.
Thank you so much to David Cote for being on the show. This CubeSat project, I think, is very, very exciting. How cool it would be. And it's cool that he's open sourcing everything so we can all take a look. So I am just terribly, terribly excited for this project. I'm so happy that he's got enough funding where it'll definitely happen. So it's going to be so fun when he gets his website open going and they get the satellite up there and we're able to look at pictures and watch some video and whatever other telemetry he gets. And for those of you, who do have criticism, so like Martin talked about, you know, people were saying, hey, you can't use this or that or this isn't going to work. Please do get that information over to them because that'll make for a better satellite. And, crowdsourcing funds is one thing. That's, of course, very helpful. But crowdsourcing thought, you know, the brain power and the whole brainstorming to make this project as successful and useful as possible is great. So get your information over to them at their CubeSat for Disclosure Indiegogo so that they can have as cool of as useful as a product as possible. And then, you know, once they launch this one and it burns up in the atmosphere and dies after they get all their hard work and money to get it up there, you know, that'll give us all some insight so we'll be able to, or someone will be able to make a better, bigger and better satellite going forward, because I have a feeling this is just going to be the beginning of, you know, private civilian satellites up in space. How exciting is that? That's so cool. So I'm really excited for that. Good luck to him and his project and the rest of the group there. Otherwise, thank you to Martin Willis for joining us for the news and sharing the news about Art Bell. Very interesting. I hope that, you know, everything goes well for Mr. Bell there. I hope that, you know, his family remains safe and that all of his concerns get taken care of and that he goes on to live a happy and happy life. I know he's got, you know, a daughter who's pretty young that he's taking care of. I know that is very important to him being a father. So I hope everything goes well. And, after all, you can't fault someone for focusing on their parental responsibilities and wanting to prioritize being a good parent, because really that's vital. That is so super important. And I have a great respect for people who, focus on their children and making sure that their children grow up safe and happy and well. So I hope everything goes well for him. And I hope everything goes well for the other shows that were on his network, because there were some great shows. There's some great people. And I hope everything goes okay. Dr. J, in fact, who's on his network, will be at the UFO Congress. He'll be introducing Merrill Cook, who's a friend of his and who he helped us get at the UFO Congress. So Merrill Cook being the congressman that I mentioned earlier. So it's going to be a fun UFO Congress. And speaking of the UFO Congress, I don't think I've told all of you listeners yet, because it's only happened like in the last week or so. The schedule is up. So that's what Martin was referring to. On Sunday, you'll see special guests. We haven't announced that special guest, but this is really exciting. We hopefully will be announcing that anytime now. So that's going to be really cool. But otherwise, you can see the entire schedule and the amazing lineup. This is the 25th anniversary of the UFO Congress, and I think our lineup is befitting of the 25th anniversary. It really is going to be something special. You'll be able to see what I mean when you go look at all the speakers and the schedule there. So really exciting event this year. Of course, last year was exciting. Every year is. So I'm just so happy that I think we are following up with an equally as impressive conference this year as last year. A lot of people are saying, how are you going to top that? Well, go look at UFOCongress.com and you'll see how we're topping that. So really cool stuff, and I'd love to meet you there. It's always exciting to meet my listeners, because the Open Minds UFO Radio listeners are just amazing people. Some of the most amazing people on the planet and off planet, because who knows? There could be off-planet people listening to our podcast every week, and that would be cool. We definitely have people from all over the world, so it's a lot of fun. Let's see, what else? The UFO Report on YouTube, check that out. And if you haven't seen it, we have an Allagash documentary on YouTube. So Michael Klein, our video guy, he put together an amazing documentary with the interviews we have from the gentlemen from Allagash, Maine, who say or believe they may have had an abduction experience, but they've had an amazing UFO sighting. And this documentary is really cool. So we have it up on YouTube for free. Check that out. We also have on our website the Travis Walton panels. So I talked about a lot about the Skyfire Summit, which was a 40th anniversary event for Travis Walton, and it was in Heber near where the site where the Travis Walton experience happened. Another very credible possible alien abduction experience. A really credible case. And what's really cool about this is that, you know, at this 40th anniversary event that took place last month, there were a couple of people involved with the case 40 years ago who haven't really spoken to the public before or often. And that being that you can see on some of these panels, in the witness panel, we had Mike Rogers, Jean Goulet, and Travis Walton. Mike Rogers being the guy who was kind of the lead character in the movie Fire in the Sky, if you saw that. But, of course, he was the head of the logging group that went out there and saw this UFO and saw Travis get beamed by it. So he was there. He had some really interesting things to say, including some guilt attached to leaving Travis after they saw him get beamed or something. So that's really cool. And then also the other panel was the investigation panel with Chuck Ellison, who is a police officer that was first on the scene. So we get to hear – now, he hasn't talked with these guys in decades. Nobody really knew what he was going to say, but you're going to be able to hear what his thoughts were about talking with these guys after the events took place. And then also Travis's brother, Dwayne, I think his name – I'm pretty sure I have that right. I apologize if I do not. But Travis's older brother, and his perspective is around – how he thought law enforcement was handling things. Also, we have some people interact with Chuck Ellison to talk about how they felt law enforcement handle things when this all happened. And also how he dealt with the media and everything else. You know, the family had the media coming down on them and a lot going on during that time. So we got some insights in these videos that nobody's seen anywhere else. So really important events. And we've got have those DVDs. They're only $10 each. And we have them up on the store on Open Minds. We can keep you up to date on all of this if you join our email list. If you go to openminds.tv in the upper right-hand corner, you'll see the email list. We can keep you up to date on what's going on with the conference, all the new products such as the t-shirts we have in our store, the latest UFO report, everything. We keep you up to date. We only email out usually bi-weekly. Unless we have some important announcement, so we don't spam you or blitz you with emails. And you can go subscribe, or you can even email us at contact@openminds.tv and say, hey, add me to your email list, and we'll get you on there so you can keep up to date with everything. Anyway, thank you to Caleb Hakes for the opening and close music, and thank you all for listening. I don't think we'll be able to have a show. Yeah, we'll probably have a show before the holidays. I'll do my best to get one out next week. I should be able to. But until then, you all have a great holiday season. Don't get trampled at the Walmart. Be careful out there with your holiday shopping. Thank you all so, so much for listening. And adios, muchachos.